I had committees all day.
So good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. A couple of housekeeping matters we need to take care of. Looking at today's agenda, Senate Bill 364 is going to be taken off of today's agenda based on the interested parties needing to have a little bit more time to work. They're working on an amendment, and so we will not be taking any public hearing testimony today on Senate Bill 364. Also regarding the agenda, we do have introduction of committee bills, which we'll be doing after I make this next announcement. But we're going to move Senate Bill 360 to the front of the hearings today just to put some stuff on the record, and then we'll move forward from there into 359 and then into our two House bills. So with that, we're going to go ahead and open up a work session for the purpose of introduction of committee bills.
Mr. Chair, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee measures: LC 2132, dated 11/26/14; LC 2135, dated 12/4/14; LC 2772, dated 2/19/15; LC 2794, dated 2/23/15; LC 2988, dated 2/3/15; LC 3097, dated 2/20/15; LC 3245, dated 2/23/15; LC 3435, dated 2/18/15; and LC 3436, dated 1/30/15.
All right, so Senator Cruz has moved for the introduction of the LCs that he just listed, and I'll just give the LCs real quick. LC 2132, 2135, 2772, 2794, 2988, 3097, 3245, 3435, 3436. Before we ask for a vote on this, I do want to give the disclaimer qualifying statement that a vote by members today does not mean they are supporting the measure itself. This is a process that we use within the legislature to allow for introduction of bills, and that each of the members will look at the concepts that are being brought forward and what, if any, amendments, if they actually move forward, before they make a decision as to whether they will be supporting or opposing the concepts that are being introduced today. Any discussion?
Yeah, plus they might not even end up in this committee.
And so that's correct. They may not be in this committee. They may not even, and if they make it to this committee, they may not even get a hearing.
That's true.
Is there any other discussion or comments? Any objection to the motion? Not seeing any, so ordered. And we'll close the work session for the introduction of committee measures. And as I stated, I'm going to go ahead and take Senate Bill 360 because I have individuals that have other commitments, and I know we're going to need to take a little bit of time on Senate Bill 359. So we'll open up our first public hearing on Senate Bill 360. Laura?
Yes, Chair Prezansky, members of the committee. Senate Bill 360 comes to us at the request of the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary. We don't have all the paperwork back for this yet. We don't have any amendments before us today. So current Oregon law does not require a seller of residential real property to disclose if the property is located within 1 mile of land included in an inventory of significant mineral or aggregate resources pursuant to a statewide land use planning goal. Senate Bill 360 requires such a disclosure and also contains some non-substantive Scrivener's changes.
All right. So the intent for the chair is to just put a few things on the record. I expect that we're going to have a work group that's going to be working on this in a little bit more detail as to maybe other means of dealing with the issue. So I'm going to go ahead and call Alex Kyler up since he is here. And then we'll call up the others just to, again, set the framework for a work group.
Good morning, committee. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Alex Kyler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. Lane County is in support of Senate Bill 360. Senate Bill 360 is not the normal type of bill that you'd see the county testifying on. Typically, I pay more attention to things that are of, you know, fiscal impact to the county or operational impact to the county. However, in this case, we have had in front of the Board of County Commissioners a number of conflicts between neighboring folks who live adjacent to mining sites and the mine operators themselves within Lane County. And unfortunately, what this does is it puts the Board of County Commissioners in a situation where they're essentially forced to choose between two constituents in terms of taking action. And in some cases, there's really nothing they can do. But what we typically hear in front of the Board of County Commissioners when neighbors come is, I didn't know that that was going to be a mining operation when I moved here. So when these were there was a lot of public comment and outcry at our public comment periods over a particular mine in Dexter. There was an operation up in Coburg that was two operations in Coburg that have led to comments. And these things deal with things that are admittedly nuisance, blasting, early morning truck traffic, nighttime truck traffic, lights, grading operations, taking down of trees and removal of vegetation, all kinds of things. The simple fact of the matter is, though, under Senate Bill 100, these are protected resource sites. The idea was that the counties, when they created their comprehensive plans, would identify significant resource areas for aggregate and protect them from encroaching uses such that that aggregate could be extracted and be utilized closest to the places where it's going to be needed. I want to make a couple points about the language in the bill. First, I want you to notice that it says significant resource sites.
Alex, I think at this point, because that's going to be stuff that the work group's going to go forward on, and so I'm not sure really setting the record at this point is necessary.
Okay.
All right.
Yep. Okay. Could I make one more comment?
You may.
I think you're going to hear a lot of testimony about that there are other ways to get neighbors to be aware that they're going to be moving into someplace where there may be resource aggregate extraction. And that's fine. We're totally open to other ways to get this done. There may be a lot of discussion about the Dugami website and how useful it is, and I'd urge the committee members to actually take a look at the Dugami website. It is not like going onto your iPhone and putting in your address and figuring out where the nearest restaurant is that you want to choose. It may not be as user-friendly as it would hope to be in this kind of particular case. And the Dugami office is only open to the public, very limited amount of time for customer service assistance. So just a couple things to keep in mind.
Yeah, and we will. I'm going to actually have you on the work group.
Okay.
And I will also be part of that work group since this is a bill that I actually brought forward for constituents. So we definitely will make sure we have everyone engaged.
Great. Thank you.
Was there any questions for Alex at this point? All right. Thank you.
Yep.
All right. So then Sean, Rich, and John, whoever wants to come up. I didn't see. Oh, there it is. Yeah, he's in the back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, Sean Jillians representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. Certainly agree with the sentiment of informing home purchasers of where potential aggregate sites might be. Unfortunately, we don't agree with the method of getting there. So just wanted to put on the record our objection to amending the statewide seller's property disclosure, which would impact every single home sale in the state for a very specific targeted sort of thing. As we discussed, and I've discussed with many of the committee members, Mr. Chair, we do think there's a potential better path with a buyers and sellers advisory, which is published not only by our association, but the Oregon Real Estate Agency as well, given to all potential purchasers of property, where we could work on language in the work group to best inform people. We're not wed to the Dugami website. If there's a better spot to put information that's easily accessible for folks, I think we would do that. I would say the one thing that I took from the testimony, though, of how unuser-friendly Dugami's website is imagine every single home seller then now having to figure out whether or not they are, if there's not that adequate resource, hence our trepidation with the bill. With that, Mr. Chair, happy to answer any questions. Happy to work with you on the
Thank
work
you.
Group.
Next.
Good morning, committee. On the judiciary, my name's Rich Angstrom. I'm the president of the Oregon Concrete and Aggregate Producers Association. We looked at this bill, and obviously I've been engaged a lot in the conversation in Eugene area over this last year. And where we agree that there needs to continue to be better communications around where the mine sites are and how just even some of the permitting flow goes on a series of bills that are out there that are all in the tone of having better conversation and communications with the citizens of Oregon. This particular bill, we think, our concern is, as the realtors have laid out, one of some liability-related issues. One is that we don't think most folks even have a clue where most of the mine sites are and wouldn't know. And it's not like when you're doing a disclosure on a house and you're looking at, whether or not the foundation's right or they know any other issues that are particularly related to the house. This is outside of that, and it would require them to have knowledge within a mile of what's going on in their, really even outside of their neighborhood. So we think there's a better solution, at least from my side. And I was a little surprised by Alex's comment, because I actually was on the website this morning and looking at it. And I thought it was, it took me two clicks, one to get to the Dogami website and one to hit the map. And it's right there. And it lists everything out. Not only that, but it lists it out to longitude, latitudes, gives name of owner, contact information, and all that kind of stuff. But the point is, even if there is, I'm maybe looking at that website from the eyes of somebody that's in the mining industry, and we, see it very clearly how it may be laid out. I think that probably it would be a good idea to have somebody from Dogami that works on the website also attend the work group, because I think if there's a conversation about how to make it better so it's more apparent for the citizens to see it as soon as it comes up as they're looking for it, that's a worthwhile discussion. But from the mining perspective, it's used a lot. We find it a very useful link, and it's two clicks. So with that, I would love to participate in the work group.
John?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, supporting exactly what was said by my colleagues to my right and left with a couple of additionals. One, if seller's disclosure is functional as for the purpose of informing people, and obviously my folks have to fill these out as well, if it's information the seller actually has, and as long as there's an I don't know box on there, and as long as the data on mine sites or anything else we might be asking about is as scarce as it seems to be, you're going to get a lot of I don't knows, which really doesn't get you to the ultimate objective of letting citizens know what might be a conflict with their use of a piece of property. So that's one thing we got to be focusing on. These resources were supposed to have been identified 30-some-odd years ago, and I know we've been busy. But at some point, maybe that'd be a good project for someone to complete. And the second thing is that from a home builder's perspective, we obviously want to, like everybody else, we want to make sure our customers know exactly what they're getting into. That assumes a better set of data, which probably, we're agnostic as to whether that shows up on the Dogami website or the real estate agency's website or some other, it doesn't matter, as long as it's reliable, it actually tells the consumer something that's useful. I think this bill right now doesn't necessarily get that objective. It sounds like a good conversation to have. Last thing, Mr. Chair and members, I'd just like to say that I'm busy when the work group meets. It's weird, but just for the record, that's the entire rest of session for this purpose only. It's tied up.
John, thank you very much for letting us know what your schedule is. All right, so is there any questions for any of the gentlemen? Thank you all very much. I just wanted to see if anyone else did come in wanting to give testimony on 360, knowing that we are going to do a work group, not seeing anyone come forward. We will be closing the public hearing on 360. Laura will be our key person that will be setting up for the work group, and we'll take a note, and we'll see if we can't get Dogami to be a participant of it as well. So with that, we close the 360. We're now going to go ahead and open up public hearing on Senate Bill 359.
Laura? As Chair Pruszynski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 359 comes to us at the request of the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary. This bill is ready to move today. It's got no revenue impact. A fiscal statement is issued that's indeterminate. There are no amendments before us today either. So Senate Bill 359 modifies the appeal fees that may be charged in quasi-judicial review of city or county land use application decisions. The bill also contains non-substantive Scrivener's changes.
All right. I'm looking at who's on the list, and I'm also looking at who's in the room. So I see Representative Helms here. I'm assuming you're here on 359. So, Jonathan, how did you want to proceed? Would you like to have the representative come up with you?
Sure.
All right. And is there any a third person you'd like to have come up?
Up to you, Mr. Chair, of course.
All right. Y'all two come on up. Thank you both for being here. And whoever would like to start.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ken Helm. I'm a representative from District 34 in Beaverton, and representing Beaverton, Rock Creek, West Haven, and the Cedar Hills neighborhood in Beaverton. I mostly came today to answer questions that the committee might have about local appeals processes. I'm not here to testify either in favor or as opposed to this bill at this point. It may end up over a course in the House in one of the committees that I sit on. Some of you may know that in my day job, a large part of my legal practice is as a land use hearings officer. So I deal with local appeals every day, and I thought that I might be helpful to you in answering questions about how that process works, and give you an idea of how complex or expedient those processes can be in terms of financial impacts on the local governments. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer those now, or I can give you a rough overview of my experiences.
Why don't you just give us an overview of your experiences, and I think what we can do, Representative, I'm not sure what your schedule is for today. You're more than welcome to stay and listen to the testimony. Then if you're available, we could have you come back up at that time. If not, I think the members individually could reach out to you after hearing whatever the testimony is and get your perspective.
Very good. Okay. Local appeals can take different forms, and they often do across the state. Before coming to serve in the legislature, I was a land use hearings officer in 6 jurisdictions. And the techniques those jurisdictions use were different. Starting with the counties, the 2 counties that I worked now in used a land use hearings officer to hear both appeals of planning director's decisions and to process land use applications that ranged widely from subdivision applications to conditional use applications to plan amendments. One of those jurisdictions simply had, with one land use type exception, all appeals would go directly to LUBA. And the internal appeal of a planning director's decision to the hearings officer, as if my memory is correct, was $250. So in that jurisdiction, the county commission made a decision that they had a lot of faith in their zoning ordinance and their comprehensive plan, and that the hearings officer, if the hearings officer did a good job, all the issues would be correctly vetted and analyzed, and they felt confident sending those decisions directly to LUBA. To give you an idea of how well that worked for them, in the 5 years that I served for Clackamas County, I had approximately 150 decisions that I issued for them. 2 of those were remanded. About 10 of those 150 cases, maybe 12, were appealed to LUBA and affirmed. So I think that tells you how effective a hearings officer can be at the local level. The other county has a slightly different approach. The hearings officer does most of the work there too, but there is an option for participants to appeal to the county commission. And once appealed to the county commission has the decision to go ahead and defer the decision directly to LUBA, which in my experience they did quite often, or take up the appeal. themselves. And once they do that, they do have a certain number of costs that they have to account for in holding those local appeals before the county commission. Again, in that county hearings officer's decision, and I was one of two there, were largely affirmed. So another example there of if you got good hearings officers, you're going to get good results. In the cities that I work in, there's just a variety of different ways that they do it. I've been a hearings officer for the city of Portland. Different types of decisions have an appeal route up to the city council. And once the city council or gets a hold of them, you never know what's going to happen, quite honestly. And those, my observation over time is that for all the jurisdictions that run their local land use decisions through a planning commission, either a local appeal from a hearings officer to the planning commission or an appeal of a planning commission decision through the city council, those decisions end up getting politicized to some degree. The findings typically reflect that. It's my observation that more of those cases end up going to LUBA and that they're less predictable in terms of success affirming the city's decision when they get to LUBA. The city of Eugene happens to be one of those. Hearings officer starts out the process. The planning commission has a chance to change it, and then sometimes the city council gets involved. Again, my experience is the success at LUBA of affirming a planning commission's decision from the city of Eugene is variable. So there's a number of ways to do this. It's also typically my experience that in jurisdictions that have local appeals through the planning commission, city council, that they incur costs that for city attorney services if they have to contract out for those. And many small cities do exactly that. And the planning commission and the city council, of course, understandably, want to take advantage of the security of having their city attorney there, particularly for controversial issues. So they incur that cost along the way as well. Before I finish up, I think one other consideration that is very relevant here and that you may be familiar with is that city council decisions and county commission decisions are under statute entitled to some deference from the Land Use Board of Appeals in how the board reviews the findings that are appealed to the board. If those findings are deemed to be plausible, both the Land Use Board of Appeals and the Oregon Court of Appeals are required to defer to the local decision maker's approach, even when the findings do not stick tightly to the text of the local zoning provision that they're interpreting. That was a practice that has evolved over time, and I think the way that that plays into your decision making is to understand that local governments do want to take advantage of that. It's optional, obviously, and it does incur a cost.
Wonderful. Any questions for the representative at this point? Senator Burdick?
Yeah, you, Mr. Chair, thank you. So you have some counties and cities that don't allow for this process of, in other words, that skip past the county commissioner, the city council, skip past it. How does that work, and how does that protect the due process of the people who are involved in the decision?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, yes, it's not that they don't. It's true that they do not allow an appeal up to the Board of Commissioners. Just so that you know, the county, Clackamas County does this. Clackamas County has a high number of appeals to the Land Use Board of Appeals, very active population there, involved citizenry. The way that I like to look at it is the Board of County Commissioners has a lot of faith that their local development code has been well crafted, and that the local development code expresses their intent very well. So they do not feel a need to have a second crack at interpreting it through the local land use process. There's one exception in Clackamas County that's important, and that is that the local citizens are allowed to file an application to have a specific provision of the zoning code interpreted prior to the time that they make an application under it. That application also goes in front of the hearings officer, and that's the one instance that I mentioned before where the hearings officer's decision is appealable up to the Board of Commissioners. And I think that works well for them, because if there is a true interpretational controversy over a specific provision of their zoning code, then the Board of Commissioners gets to weigh in. I've observed that working very well for them.
And Mr. Chair?
Yes.
In cases where the appeal is allowed to the governing body, the city council or the county commission, I understand there's a huge range of fees that are charged. And is there any system that you think could be developed to have kind of a standardized formula for having those fees?
Chair Przanski, I'm Senator Burdick.
Is this where I step in and say Senate Bill 359?
Obviously, this bill does present one uniform way to do it. In my job, I get to work with local planning staff all the time, and I get to see the different degrees of difficulty of cases and their different involvement. It is quite true that certain cases will take more time and effort of the local staff. It may take being at evening hearings, for example, and I assume that they may be getting overtime for the time. So it does vary. I think you're in the process of balancing two different competing policy priorities or options. One is the ability of the average citizen to participate in a land use conversation that may directly impact their property. I mean, often neighbors are getting involved because they are right next door to something that's being proposed. They are genuinely concerned that it's going to affect their quality of life. And they're just regular folks. They're unfamiliar with the land use system. They're not land use planners. They're not land use attorneys. And often they don't have a lot of spare cash. Then on the other side, you've got cities and counties with restricted budgets that are trying to make the most of what they can do with their planning budgets, and appeals do cost them money. And so balancing that in a rational way, I think, is the nut of the question in front of you, is how to make sure we get enough public access to the land use process without putting an undue financial burden on the local governments.
Mr. Chair, if I could just ask one more follow-up. In areas that don't have that step, that go directly to LUPA, how are the interests of the landowner, the next door to one of these things, how are they protected? Do they suffer from lack of access to the process?
Chair Przanski and Senator Burdick, in my experience, no. And here's why. You do have the local land use hearing process. All parties are invited. Folks get notice for a specified area, and then there are other ways that people get notice informally. There's no limit, typically, on who can participate in those local hearings. In most cases, all persons that are interested in testifying and bringing up their issues are allowed to do so at those local hearings in front of a hearings officer, for example. And then sending the appeal directly to LUBA from a participant's point of view is a fairly inexpensive procedure. LUBA's fees, I think, are in the $400 range right now. So you, as a participant at the local level, if you want to participate at LUBA, the cost of admission is about $400. You do not need to be represented by an attorney at LUBA. And in fact, many pro se participants are very effective, very effective. So their due process rights are preserved in a different forum that, again, is inexpensive and equally open, so long as those people that are appealing to LUBA have adequately raised all the issues that they want to talk about at the local level. And they're apprised of those regulations at the beginning of the local hearing and can move forward under those sideboards.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions for Senator Thatcher?
So if a city is limited or a county is limited in the fees they can charge, that would encourage them to send them on if they would be losing money by accepting this proposition. Really, right? I mean, it would kind of make them think twice about taking on the appeal. It would probably encourage them to send it on to LUBA. Is that kind of the point? Or
Chair Przanski, Senator Thatcher, I think some local governments have already made that calculus and decided to go in that direction, yes.
Right.
Let me add one thing there that I don't know if I'm anticipating where you think you might be going there. And that is, if a local government does decide to send decisions directly to LUBA, and it's not just hearings officers' decisions, by the way. The city of Warrenton has a process by which the city council passes through essentially their planning commission's decisions directly to LUBA. So it can happen in both ways. The question naturally arises, is the city going to be taking on additional costs to defend those decisions at LUBA with their contract attorney time or contract city attorney time or their on-staff city attorney or county council? And it is the practice of many jurisdictions out there not to defend any land use decision that is made by their planning commission or city council. They have the option to do so, of course, but they will typically allow the applicant to defend a decision if the applicant is successful. And my experience is the applicant is successful 80% to 90% of the time at the local level. In other words, a local applicant is being approved most of the time.
Any other questions or comments for the representative? Thank you very much, and
I'm happy to stay in case there's questions.
If you, that'd be great. So what I'm going to go ahead and do is, Jonathan, before you get started, why don't we go ahead and call up Peggy Lynch and Steve McCoy, since all three of you are on the proponent side, and then we'll take the opponents after that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Manton, and I'm here today representing Central Oregon Land Watch. Land Watch has been advocating for sensible land use policies in Central Oregon for over 25 years, and we've been part of this conversation now for about 5 years. We first brought a bill forward, I believe it was in 2011, and we had a work group during this past year, which I had the good fortune to be able to sit on. I want to just make sure that we kind of are clear about where we're talking about on the process here. Basically, three steps in the land use process. First would be an applicant comes before the hearings officer, as described by Representative Helm. The second would be this appeal to the city council or county commission. That's the second step. The third step in the process would be, of course, going to LUBA. So we're talking about this fee at the second step. And as was mentioned by Senator Burdick, the range in these fees is widely variant. Most cities and counties across the state charge this appeal fee of about $250 or $400. Some are $500, some are $600. But in some instances, it's much, much higher than that. A couple examples of that. In Klamath County, the fee is over $10,000 in some instances, especially for like a destination resort. In Deschutes County, they use a base fee plus a percentage of the application cost, which drives the cost up to approaching $5,000 for an appeal fee. At this level, individual citizen groups are simply just not able to access that process. And that violates the first principle of our land use system is goal one. The idea of why do we need a cap? Why can't we do something else? We've tried to have these conversations, as I said, for the last 5 years, including a work group. And they're just, despite the kind of cities and counties knowing that they're being alerted that it's a problem, things are moving in the opposite direction. So right now in Deschutes County, there's a subdivision applicant that's actually five different, it's 50 homes. It's being broken down into five different proposals. So instead of an appeal to this county commission going forward to challenge this development, it's being proposed in an urban fire interface. Instead of paying a $5,000 fee for this development, they've broken it into five different developments. So it's actually going to be about a $25,000 appeal fee. And this is laid out in Paul Dewey's testimony, which you have on the record. So despite kind of this conversation happening, things are going in the wrong direction, I'm afraid. A cap is very consistent with statute currently. So for the first step in the process with the hearings officer, statute now says that has a cap of $250. For the third step in the process at LUBA, there's a cap of $400. So the cap proposed in Senate Bill 359 of 1,000 or 10% of the application fee is consistent with caps for the other two stages. No one is interested in creating financial hardship for cities and counties in this. And Senate Bill 359 would not create that undue financial burden on the local government level. And there are three reasons. And we've heard this so much that it just brings to mind terms, right? So we use the term poppycock. Or my favorite one.
Whipsnead.
Yeah, whipsnead.
Boulderdash.
Boulderdash. Horse pucky. My favorite one is actually hogwash. But it's just this bill wouldn't do that. And the reason is basically there are three reasons. We heard in the work group, one of the opponents of this conversation was saying that I asked them how often do these appeals actually happen at that particular county level. And it was very infrequent, right? It's one to two a year that actually are required to pay this amount of fee, possibly less than that. In Landwatch's 25-year history, they've gone to LUBA on average about one time a year. And they've been the prevailing party about 70% of that time. So these types of appeals at the county commission that are so expensive, supposedly, can be expensive, don't happen very often. If you don't buy that one, the second one is that the appearance now, or that the statute now allows the cities or counties to charge in this fee the average of the actual costs. But the cities and counties get to determine exactly what that cost is. So by hiring attorneys to defend these, their decisions of the hearing officer, the attorneys can often charge $300 an hour and above. So they get to drive the costs up and then charge that cost on the front end as an appeal fee for the future proceedings. But those costs are entirely determined by the city and county themselves. We looked into some of their costs during the work group, and they also included the cost of operating the public buildings, staff time that were dedicated to preparing materials that these staff folks are already employed by the county. So there's every incentive to double dip the cost. There's no limit on what the cost can be, and it's all determined by the city and the county themselves. Finally, if those two arguments don't persuade you, the third, as has been mentioned, is that there's no reason that the cities and counties have every opportunity themselves to just not have this hearing if it's going to cost them so much money and forward the proceeding up to LUBA. They can adopt as a final order the ruling of the hearings officer, and then the proceedings go up to LUBA, where the fee is $400. And as Senator Burdick was talking about, citizens can access that process at LUBA. They can access the hearings officer decision at the first step. And the folks that we represent are those very citizens. The lack of the access problem comes in when they set the fee so high that you can't afford to have the hearing at the second step. You have to exhaust your local remedies before you get to LUBA. So if you have a $10,000 fee at the second step that citizens can't afford, you have no access from that point on. You can't get to LUBA because you can't afford to pay the fee at the second step. So the access question is the problem we're exactly trying to address with this bill. Does that make sense? So, and then I just, would close by mentioning that, the fee that's been proposed in this bill is 2.5 times the charge. If it winds up being $1,000, it's 2.5 times larger than the fee at LUBA. It's 4.5 times. It's 4 times larger than the $250 fee at the hearings officer level. So this is a moderate approach to try to increase access to this land use system on behalf of citizens. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. I'd like to go ahead and do the panel and then open up for questions. So whoever would like to go next?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, I am Steve McCoy representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 359. The first thing I'd like to stress is that not every local government charges exorbitant appeal fees. You've already heard that, but that is certainly the case. However, some do, and that number is growing. And by exorbitant, what I'm talking about is appeal fees in the thousands or tens of thousands of dollars. So what we're talking about is local land use appeals for quasi-judicial decisions. So let me unpack that a little bit. So we're talking about local land use appeals, so the decision has already been made by the local government, and it's an appeal. So all the legal due diligence should be done at this point. There should be a record of the decision. The staff work has been done. The issues have been raised. Continuing to unpack local land use appeals of quasi-judicial decisions, we get that they are appeals of quasi-judicial land use decisions. So what are these? Typically, it's a single property or a single project. It is an applicant that is going and seeking a permit. So these are simpler decisions than local government legislative decisions, which are can be large and complex. We're not talking about a cap on those in this bill. So it's only for the quasi-judicial ones, only for the simpler decisions. And typically, only a few provisions of a comprehensive plan are going to apply to these decisions. So we're talking about a local government reviewing a decision that has been made by another part of that local government, where the legal and staff work has presumably already been done. I mean, the local government isn't going to be making a decision without doing its legal due diligence. So presumably, they have already done that. So why is the appeal so expensive? In some cases, for example, recently in Hood River, it was perversely the local government requiring the appellant to bear the cost of the local government burnishing its case. And so what they did was they charged the complete cost of their attorney fees to the appellant. So the appellant had to pay their attorney fees as well as the local government's attorney fees. Even if they had won the case, that would have been the case. And the local government, of course, used that attorney's time to burnish its case, work on its findings. So working exactly against the person that was paying the attorney is crazy. So currently, the law requires that local appeal fees be reasonable and no more than the actual or average costs of the appeal. Jonathan talked about the actual and average costs. I want to talk about the reasonable part. The reasonable part has been read out of the law by LUBA. They haven't reached the reasonable prong ever, as far as I know. And what they do is they say, well, if it's average or actual, then it's reasonable. And then they just move on. So if there was life in that reasonable part, then we wouldn't be here today. So I don't know if I need to go over the hogwash and balderdash anymore.
I didn't wear my bow tie today.
Yeah, I think it's been talked about how local governments are not required to take appeals of local quasi-judicial land use decisions. One thing that's important that I think came out in Representative Helms' testimony is that whenever these appeals do go to the Board of Commissioners or to the City Council, at that point these are, again, quasi-judicial. Which means that they are supposed to be sitting in the seat of a judge, that they are supposed to be not looking at the politics of it, but instead looking at the legal aspects of it. So the political body is not required to get involved at all. If it does, they should be sitting in the seat of a judge. So if they choose to take appeals when they are acting in a judge-like role, it follows that the appeal fees should be reasonable. Thank you.
Money. Peggy?
Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League of Women Voters is a nonpartisan grassroots political organization that encourages informed and active participation in government. I have to say that every time, and particularly since I haven't been before this committee this time. The League supports our statewide land use planning program with local implementation. We hear oftentimes that the statewide program is this overarching boogeyman. But in fact, every jurisdiction and every group of citizens in local jurisdictions get to help develop their comprehensive plan and their development codes. And land use planning isn't this esoteric thing. It's about where people live. It's about where people work. It's about where they play, they shop, and how they get there. And that's the important part about this discussion. We are not talking about some sort of legal book that's dry on a shelf. This is about our very lives. And therefore, it's really important that we all have that conversation about what our communities are going to look like. We work very hard to make sure that our citizens participate in the legislative side, in the comprehensive plan and the development code creation, making sure that that we have this vision for what our cities and counties look like. But the truth is, the policy documents sometimes lack clarity and may be applied in a manner that those participating feel is incorrect. At that point, those appealing should have reasonable access to their local elected officials. Remember that appellants might be the original applicant and not just the neighbors. And it's sometimes true that the applicant, him or herself, may say, wait a minute, the Planning Commission or the person below the final elected official has really interpreted the code and development and the comp plan incorrectly. You've heard about LUBA and how it provides reasonable access, but there should not be an unreasonable barrier to the local government decision makers even before the LUBA appeal. In fact, clarity of interpretation of a local decision belongs first with the local authority, the county or city elected officials. Access to those bodies should not be barred by an unreasonable appeal fee. And you have heard that many jurisdictions don't have that unreasonable appeal fee, but unfortunately we do have some that do. And it is unfair that some citizens in our state would have that kind of burden as they try to help make their community a better place to live. So, we're willing to answer questions. On a personal basis, I served as the chair of the State Citizen Involvement Advisory Committee. I have been doing land use as a volunteer citizen since 1972, and the issues about which I have spent most of my time have been on citizen involvement and making sure that everybody has a voice when we develop our communities. So I'm here to answer questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Burdick, did you have a question?
Yes, I did. Jonathan, you said that if somebody didn't go through the city council for that process, or let's just say city council or county commission, that they would not be able to move on to LUBA? They don't have the opportunity to go directly to LUBA from the hearings officer level?
Chair Przanski and Senator Burdick, not exactly. So if I said I might have misspoke that, I apologize. In order to get to LUBA, you have to exhaust local your local remedies. So if the appeal fee is so high at the step two, at the county commission level, then you don't get to have a hearing at the county commission because you can't afford to pay the fee there. So that's where the citizen would be stopped in their tracks because they weren't able to pay the fee to get to have the hearing at step two. So then you wouldn't be able to go to step three. However, if in the instance that the city or county decided we're going to not have this hearing because it is so expensive.
The step two.
Step two. Then that decision would be passed on to LUBA, and the citizens do have access to go to LUBA at that point. So the county would have that discretion to say, okay, we don't want to have this hearing in this instance because it's too expensive, or for whatever reason they decide. They have the entire discretion to do that now. So they can say, we don't want to do this. If that happens, then the appeal would go to LUBA, where all parties have access. If you have standing at LUBA, you would pay a $400 fee there. And one of the things that I forgot to mention in my first piece of testimony is that if that happens, if the county says at step two, nope, too expensive, just go take this to LUBA, then the parties go to LUBA, then LUBA does not give that decision the same level of deference that it would had they acted at step two. But LUBA will still be acting on the merits of the case at that point. I think the opponents of this bill will say that they lose deference in this instance, and I think Senator Thatcher was mentioning that point as well. But what I would say in response to that is that LUBA will still act on the merits of the case. And this bill has nothing to do with pro-development, anti-development, either side of the land use system. These fees apply equally to everyone who would pay them. So if you were, if your application was denied, if you wanted to do a development and your application was denied at the hearings office level, you would then need to make an appeal to the county commissioner, and you're subject to the same exorbitant high fees in those instances as well. So this is not outcome determinative or on the merits. It's just setting a fair fee that would apply to everybody equally.
Yeah, so let me just kind of restate that. Depending on the model of what the city or the county has, will dictate whether or not they're going to have a hearings officer's decision reviewed locally within their own system. And if they do have that, my understanding is that at that point, the city or county who has that second step makes a decision for whatever reason whether they're going to have that hearing there or not. If it's not, then the local governments has exhausted, all of their steps and got a final order from the city or from the county, then that goes on up to LUBA. Some cities and some counties say, we're not going to have that second step at all. And so automatically everyone knows that if they get a decision that's adverse to them from the hearings officer, they're going to have the right to appeal to LUBA.
I think I understand that. So if we did have a cap of some sort, the cities would always have the option of refusing to have a hearing, and then it could go directly to LUBA. So they wouldn't have to conduct the hearing if they thought the cost would be excessive. Is that correct?
Senator Przanski and Senator Burdick, that is absolutely correct. And that is the case now. This bill doesn't change that. So. As the city
Chair,
of Bend does that now, they don't have to.
I know, but Chair Przanski, Senator Burdick, I think you may hear from the opponents and hopefully they'll clarify this, but I believe that that's a local decision. In other words, it has to be in their ordinance, in their rules, in order to allow that to happen. So I just want to make sure that that's clear. Yeah. It's not an automatic. They have to have had a conversation with their citizens that this is another option to deal with land use, and then they can make that pro or con decision. But they have to have that decision first. So not every jurisdiction automatically has this kind of thing. And we do have large cities, small cities. Many don't have hearings officers and don't use hearings officers. So they use their planning commissions, who are volunteers. And again, that's another of the issues, because these planning commissioners are volunteers, some of whom take advantage of planning training, some don't. The possibility of errors in interpreting a local comp plan and development code can be greater, and therefore the opportunity for someone to go the next step to their local elected official, their city council or county government, is even more important. So we have a wide range. Remember I said that we have the statewide program with local implementation? This is a perfect example of the fact that every jurisdiction gets to do it their own way as long as they follow the basic rules. I hope that's helpful and not too confusing.
Yeah. So, Peggy, I mean, the reality is each city or county is going to make a decision through their local process as to how they're going to have these type of decisions
that's
first
correct.
Made.
That's correct.
And then what will be the appeal steps that would be available either internally, so it's still within their system,
yes,
or they could say, we have so much faith, or we will rely on the decision that's made by that hearings officer, planning commission,
right,
and their ordinances would basically state that it's automatically going to go up there. But what I think Jonathan has also brought up is that a city that has that second step,
right,
always can waive that second step for whatever reasons and say, we're going to make that first step our final decision. Now we have a final decision that can be appealed and would to LUBA. Senator Thatcher.
Thank you. Peggy, you were talking about citizen involvement and talking about how people directly impacted might need to, you know, say something about the decision. So I'm wondering how often are there people appealing that aren't necessarily neighbors, that they either come from across the state or maybe somewhere else?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Thatcher, I'm guessing not many. In almost all cases, when you hear of appeals, and you may hear, frankly, from my friends, 1,000 friends were a part of this appeal process, they have members in those local communities that, frankly, bring those issues before them, and they use the opportunity for a land use group that better understands the system to help them argue their case. But almost entirely, it tends to be local citizens saying, this is not going to work in my area. I have a real problem. Now, it may be somebody across town, not just somebody next door. And the reason for that is we're talking about the community decision and a development that may occur right next door to somebody may also have an effect on the people across the way, across the town, because of traffic issues or other kinds of impacts. So it's important that we have the opportunity for a broad range of people to appeal. But I believe that in cases even where you hear the horror stories of 1,000 friends is in my backyard again, most of the time it has to do with the fact that there are local members of 1,000 friends who have said, I have a problem.
Well, then a follow-up.
Sure.
So it sounds like there can be multiple appellants. And so would all of them be subject to this fee, sometimes in the tens of thousands that you're saying? Or can they aggregate it, you know, put a pool of money together? How does that work?
So, Senator Brzezinski, Senator Thatcher, it could be that neighbor next door who finds it a horror story for the development, or it could be a group of people. So it depends. And that group of people doesn't have to be a group of people with lots of money. It can be a group of people in an affordable housing development next door to something that's going to go in that they feel is wrong for their neighborhood. So it's not as if just because we could have 10 people who join in that appeal that they can all put in their $500 and maybe afford this. You have to consider the fact that it could just be one person appealing the project.
Yeah, I think I want to get clarification, though, for Senator Thatcher. My understanding is that one have to be part of the record to actually have something that could potentially be appealed.
Absolutely.
The real question, I think, is if you had 5 points that were raised and one of those individuals only raised one of those points, or let's say there are 5 individuals that raised a point, so you have 5 separate points that are raised, the question would be, could one of those individuals actually raise in their appeal on whatever issue they had, someone else's issue that they had, in other words, capture that other objection or whatever it may be and raise it? Or would you have to have that second, third, fourth, or fifth issue that the first person didn't raise, have to have someone come in separately and raise that on appeal to preserve that second, third, fourth, or fifth issue for a decision?
So I'm going to defer to Steve.
Okay, Chair Brzezinski. The simple answer is yes. So
all the above.
Huh? Yeah, right. So the raise it or waive it provisions that are in state law on this are specifically there so that issues do get raised in front of the local government, and the local government has the opportunity to address them. So the issue can be raised by anyone, and then an appellant will have the opportunity to, if, for example, if they didn't think of it, or if right. they split up the commenting between them and some other neighbors, then they would be able to rely on the comments that were put in by others.
All right, so you could have one person bring the appeal and take all of the issues that were raised at the hearing level that were objected to that they have issue with under one appeal.
They could do that, yes. And may I get back to Luba?
Yep.
Chair Przanski, Senator Thatcher. I think you probably all recall that in 2013, Senate Bill 77 was passed out of this committee and then became law. And that is a reporting bill that Luba must report out a whole bunch of data on cases that they get. So now we have six quarters of data in that SB 77 reporting. I will submit those to the record, and what is included in those is number of cases filed, number of cases that reach the briefing stage. A large number of cases that get filed at Luba actually get dismissed for whatever reason, either for lack of standing or people just agree. People offline talk with the local government, the local government says, okay, you're right, or, you know, let's meet somewhere in the middle, that sort of thing. So many cases just do get dismissed without ever being heard, without ever being briefed. About 20 get briefed each quarter. At least that's been the case for the last, again, six quarters. And about half of those are successful and about half of those are affirmed. Those cases are split between applicants, so between the developer and between opponents. And all that information is in that SB 77 reporting. It tells who the petitioner was, which is the appellant, the person that's appealing, and then who answered the appeal. It also goes into detail about whether the local government appeared on the appeal, because as Representative Helm said, it is common practice for local governments to approve a lot of, you know, approve 80-90% of the applications, and then to let the applicant handle the appeal then up at Luba rather than handling it themselves.
All right. Any other questions? I have one quick one, Steve, regarding your example where the attorney fees were assessed for the case in chief. I didn't realize, I don't practice this area, but the attorney fees were or potentially could be awarded in that scenario, and I'm wondering if that was just by ordinance or somehow they did that, or?
So, Chair Przanski, those attorney fees were not awarded. They were rolled into the appeal fee.
Okay.
So they charged actuals on their appeal fee, and that included the.
Thanks for the clarification.
Yeah.
So I'm going to have you all step back because we've got another panel or two, and then we have a couple more bills. So at this point, I'd like to have Nick Lelak, Aaron Doyle, and Eric Kanzler.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. It's great to be here this morning. My name is Nick Lelak. I'm the Deschutes County Community Development Director. And I've submitted written testimony yesterday in opposition to Senate Bill 359. I won't be reading that. In fact, I'll probably be curtailing my comments to provide more opportunities for you to ask questions, because I think I might be the only person here that's actually employed by local government this morning and can help answer some questions. I want to start by saying I really appreciate Representative Helm's overview of the process. It certainly establishes a nice foundation for all of us to work from, and I'm certainly very, very proud to say that he is one of our hearings officers in Deschutes County and has performed superbly for us over a number of years. And our Board of County Commissioners has extreme and extraordinary confidence in his work, and we all do. And one of the things that I want to just state at the beginning is that we have some appeal fee caps in place already, as you may know. You've heard that the $250 appeal fee cap that's in place in state law right now for the planning director's decision. Well, the consequence for that in Deschutes County, so that you understand, is if we have an application that has been submitted and we have any bit of controversy on it whatsoever, we get a letter from, for example, Central Oregon Land Watch expressing concerns, or it's a complicated matter, or it's a new interpretation of a county code or a state law, we will automatically send that to a county hearings officer. And we will charge the applicant for that. And the fee to the applicant is a $3,000 to $5,000 hearings officer deposit because they will pay 100% of those costs. Our fees previously were $150 per hour. We needed to expand our pool of hearings officers a couple of years ago. We were unsuccessful with that amount, so we had to go up to 175. I know City of Bend pays 200. Other jurisdictions pay different amounts. So the applicant pays that initial fee, and that's just a deposit. The fee could easily be $5,700, $3,300, or it can be $1,500, and we refund the balance. So we do everything we can in our power to make sure that the public has access to that first public hearing before a county hearings officer. And again, we have great confidence in that process. Our county council, our county legal counsel, et cetera, are not involved in that process whatsoever because of our confidence in the hearings officer. When that decision is rendered, we believe that is a rock-solid, sound legal decision, as Representative Helms stated. As we go from there to the Board of County Commissioners, our legal counsel becomes very involved, coordinating with the applicant's attorney, the appellant's attorney, with county staff, with the Board of County Commissioners. We hold a number of work sessions, as Ms. Lynch described. We have a work session with our Board of County Commissioners to determine if they want to hear the appeal or not. So there's a lot of work that they do. So our fee for appeals are $2,640 plus 20% of the underlying application cost. 80 to 85% of that is going to be in the mid $3,000 range. We can have a couple up to $4,000. I think the highest I've seen since I've been with the county in 6 years is about $6,000. It's important then to think about why the Board of County Commissioners would or would not want to hear a decision. And Senator Thatcher raised this earlier. Is it a financial decision? What are those factors? And I think it's been discussed a number of times that deference to the local governing body is an important factor. Well, one of the things about Deschutes County is we have a robust planning program, and we spend extraordinary resources to keep our plans and codes, et cetera, both consistent with state law, but as well as addressing local needs. So many of our codes, ordinances, plans, et cetera, are significantly more restrictive than state law. And so when those issues are on appeal, our Board of County Commissioners will be given deference at LUBA. And our board really likes to weigh in and on those so that they do have that deference when it goes either to LUBA, or if it's the first time that they've heard those, they know that they'll be setting precedent at the local level on how staff and hearings officers, et cetera, will be interpreting those. So that's an important factor in their decision-making and whether they want to hear that appeal or not. I got another number of other quick comments here. You heard about a circumstance where we have right now on the west side of Bend, 50-lot subdivision that's being proposed, and it could be five different appeal fees. There's a long story to that. It's not as simple as there might be five. By the way, the decision hasn't even been rendered, so I didn't know that it may even be on appeal. The hearings officer hasn't rendered that final decision. That's a five-phase project. We encourage them, and they agree, the applicants, to do it all in one phase so everybody can see the entire project. By the way our code works, we had to charge five different application costs, and we charged five different hearings officers' costs. However, they're going to get the refund for whatever is unspent, or we'll bill them for more, and I imagine we would do the exact same thing on appeal because it functions like one package, and we're treating it like one package going forward. I want to state that we are in the process right now of conducting our first ever comprehensive user fee study so that we will know if our fee of $2,640 and 20% of the original application costs are accurate or not. We expect to have those results from a third-party independent consultant within about 30 days. And if this process is still proceeding in this chamber or the other, we're more than happy to provide those costs if that's informative, if that's helpful or not. There was a question raised about whether outside parties that don't live near a project will appeal. Well, we have a case like that right now. And what we did at the staff level is we worked with our Board of County Commissioners and said, we have an outside party, and it is Central Oregon Land Watch, that is appealing a project in one part of in part another part of the county that they don't have any members to live around. But we realized that this is a precedent-setting case, and therefore I worked with the Board of County Commissioners for them to call up the decision immediately at no cost to anybody. So there are those circumstances, and I certainly agree with Ms. Lynch that those are rare. We don't see those very often. Generally, it's going to be a neighbor that's going to appeal the decision. Or an affected party within a general area that will appeal the decision. Another point I want to raise is that our county council's double dipping somehow. That in Deschutes County, I can only speak from our experiences, that's not accurate. I just submitted my budget last week. I paid in our indirect fees for our department, community development department, $689,000 or thereabouts, to pay for all the indirect fees that our county requires from Deschutes County, from personnel to finance to legal counsel, whatever the case may be. So we pay over $200,000 a year to our legal counsel for the services they provide to us for this. If we didn't provide those services to them, their staff wouldn't be the size that it is. They are not double dipping. Our county council is the size that it is because of the resources that we provide. So they are not double dipping in any way, shape, or form. The simple fact of the matter is going to be the effects of this are going to be, and this is what you'll hear about from other speakers, I believe, is we have really two choices. If this is capped, we don't have the choice like we have with the planning director's decision being appealed, which we pass on to the applicant. We have two choices in this case. We can either increase fees across all applications so everybody shares in those costs, or I will ask the Board of County Commissioners if they wish to offset those fees with general fund or some other revenue source. So that will be the position that we will be in to ask. I would state that as a starting point, the bill, the 10% or the $1,000 maximum, whichever is lower, could easily result in appeal fees that are significantly lower than the current $250 appeal fee, as I've run the numbers on some of our applications that are in place today. So it's not just Deschutes County, Coos County, Lane County, Clackamas County, Jackson County, a number of other counties will experience a significant reduction in revenue to pay for this cost of service if as proposed that were in place. I'm not authorized to provide any other options from our Board of County Commissioners, but as a starting point, that's a pretty tough place for us to start. So I'll conclude my remarks. Thank you.
We have 13 minutes. I've got three other people, and I've got two other bills. So however y'all like to parse the... And we're not moving the bill today, so don't think we're going to run the bill.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, Aaron Doyle with the League of Oregon Cities. I will be as brief as possible. I think Nick speaks more eloquently than those of us who just hear from everyone else. A couple of things that I'd like to point out that haven't already been addressed, but the way our fees are set at the local level is a public process. You can participate in the fee scheduling hearing when we set our fees based on a standard fee schedule. That is a public process that's open. City councils sit down, have a discussion about what costs are, how to fund things, looking at their entire budget, whether or not everything should be subsidized with the general fund, which is limited and has to be parsed out across all departments, or if we can offset some of those things with fees, which a lot of our planning departments balance the fees versus general fund offset. And that public process is also a political process, and citizens can participate there if they feel that they're consistently hamstrung by the cost of appeals fees in their jurisdictions. They can participate in that process, or they can participate in the political process and access their city council members that way. In addition, if they have a concern and they would like to have the city council directly hear it on their own motion, which would have no cost to any appellant, they can talk to their representatives on their city government and have them express the dismay of the citizenry. As far as more to the double dipping comments, a lot of the costs that we do provide include employee time, because if their time is not spent doing the appeals, they could probably be doing other work. It's not that they don't have other things to do and they're just sitting around waiting for the appeals, and that's the reason why we pay their salary, is for them to wait for these types of highly controversial appeals to show up. They're doing only so much work in their days. And so when we account for costs, we account for employee time. And so I just wanted to address that about how we provided the information during the work group that reflected city planner time or city attorney time. The other thing is not every city has a city planner on staff. This is not necessarily staff time that's being spent. And we use these folks when we take things up on an appeal, because when our city council is looking at what their planning commission or hearings officer did, they need expertise to make sure they don't run afoul of the statewide land use goals. So I'd like to also state that I appreciate what Peggy Lynch from the League of Women Voters said about this being about a local process and having local voices involved. That's why we want to do local appeals, is so maybe we can solve the problem locally, where more people have access to coming to a city council meeting and participating in that way, or having direct access to their elected officials. So it is a statewide system that we are required to implement on our own, and we make a lot of decisions about how we implement that, and we use our citizens in our planning commissions, in our pre-application meetings, in all of the different ways our planning departments are working on community outreach. And by saying, just pass it on to LUBA, you're cutting off that opportunity. And I'll leave it at that for now, but we do incur costs when we go to LUBA, and we can't ask for that money back. And we do incur costs when our citizens are unhappy, and we have a lot of processes set up by which the citizenry can access their city councils, and cutting off the fees means that that also will likely be cut off as more decisions get sent directly to LUBA. Thank you.
Thank you. And Eric, since you're representing the city of Bend, and we just had the Leagues of Cities, I imagine you're just going to tell us you agree with everything you just heard.
Chair Posansky, members of the committee, for the record, Eric Kanzler representing the city of Bend. I'm going to go a little bit further, and I'm going to tell you that I agree with everything that the League said and everything that Nick Lelak, representing Deschutes County, said. I think they spoke to the local government perspective and certainly a local perspective within Central Oregon very effectively. I'm going to jettison most of my testimony here, which is already abbreviated from the written testimony, and just let you all know that the city of Bend actually recently commissioned and completed its own fee study. It was a third-party contracting firm outside, and it went through a public process of its own in addition to just to do the fee study went through a public process. And then, of course, there's a subsequent public process to actually set fees related to that. And we determined that the average cost of processing an appeal in the city of Bend is $2,700. So that, you know, and I won't reiterate the different things that we do, because Aaron and Nick have already spoken to that, but there's considerable effort that goes into the local processes. And we do believe as well, again, that Peggy Lynch echoed this previously, that the local process is a crucial part of Oregon's land use system. Implementation, local decision-making, local involvement. It's not just the local citizens. It's what the local governments have the resources to do to help address the problems raised by the issues raised by the applicants and the problems raised by the appellants. One question that I'd like to ask, and then I'll leave it at that. To us, it's unclear whether this bill extends the appeals fees process outlined in ORS 227.180 to apply to limited land use decisions under ORS 197.195. I don't know if that's the intent of the bill or not. There's been some discussion about that at the city level. Our legal counsel reads it that it certainly could be read that way, which would be very concerning to us. So we'd like to see that question. We'd like to see an expression of the intent and an indication of what the bill would do.
Well, we're going to have a little more work group. I'm not sure why that wouldn't have come up already in the work group discussions that have previously occurred. We'll follow that up on that. Unless there's a question from for this panel, I'm going to have you all step back. And I have two other people. I've got Stephen Cafori as well as Sean Julians. What I'm going to do, gentlemen, and I'll give you each like 30 seconds if you want that, or we can put your testimony off later. I know you are here in the building more frequently.
Mr. Chair, later.
All right. Thank you very much. So I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 359. We're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on the last two bills together. This will be Senate House Bill 2327 and 2328. Laura?
Yes, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 2327 comes to us at the request of the Oregon State Bar Board of Governors, as does Senate Bill 359. There is no revenue or fiscal impact on House Bill 2327. We do have a fiscal statement issued on Senate Bill, House Bill 2328.
Okay.
I'm sorry, no fiscal on either of these, and they are ready to go.
Okay. Yeah, I think yeah. Helen, why don't you come on up, and we'll go ahead and get your testimony and see if we can't take care of business today. And thank you for waiting.
Thank you, Chair Przanski. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Helen Hirschfield, and I am General Counsel for the Oregon State Bar, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon State Bar Board of Governors to speak in support of House Bill 2327. ORS 9.705 to 755, what I call the custodianship statute, provides a process by which the Oregon State Bar can, with the court's approval and oversight, take control over a lawyer's law practice when the lawyer is no longer able to devote the time or attention to that practice. And the purpose of the statute is to protect clients' rights and ensure that the property in the custody of the lawyer gets returned to the appropriate person, the person that is entitled to that property. Until recently, the bar had not had occasion to use this statute very often, but with the grain of the Oregon State Bar, as lawyers get older, we have found that we have had occasion to want to use it several times over the past few years, and we've noticed in those occasions some limitations with the current language and process of the statute. So House Bill 2327 addresses, there are four changes that I'm going to briefly talk about.
Here, if you want to come back, well, we can carry this over, but if you'd like to get your testimony in, if you can submit whatever you want to in writing, if it hasn't already gone on to OLIS. I know the bar usually does do white papers on these.
We did submit written testimony.
I'm going to start losing members in 3.5 minutes, so.
Okay.
That's the reason I'm trying to get you up and see if we can't get your testimony in, so.
Yes, okay. So do you want me to just rely on the testimony that's been submitted, the written testimony? Is that what you're suggesting, Chair?
Well, that's normally, I mean, all of us are obligated or should be taking on the responsibility to look at what has been submitted as okay. written testimony.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming my members have done that or will be doing that.
Okay. I'm happy to rely on that written testimony and just offer to answer any questions that you all might have with respect to the two bills.
Okay. Well, the second one, I think you might want to put a little bit on the record on 2328 as to the reason for the not natural person needing to appear with an attorney.
Sure. So, Chair Przanski and members of the committee, with respect to House Bill 2328, the purpose of this statute would be to really align the statute itself with existing case law. I don't think it really makes any changes to the law as it currently stands. It simply makes it clear what the case law is. It brings it out of the court decisions and puts it directly into the statute. The statute says that persons are permitted to appear in court without an attorney, with the exception that a state or a corporation must appear through an attorney. That's the statute as it currently reads. The Oregon Court of Appeals and Supreme Court have interpreted this statute to apply more broadly and to require other business entities to also appear through an attorney. For example, LLCs, business trusts, they also must appear through an attorney in accordance with the court's case law. What we're doing with this proposed amendment is simply to bring that case law into the statute itself.
So basically, the way it's been interpreted by the courts, we're just going to align the statutes to reflect what the courts require now.
That's exactly right, Chair Przanski.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have a bill that's going to come here that's in the Human Services Committee right now that has to do with the Department of Human Services having representation when they are in court without an attorney. Does this apply also to agencies or only to businesses?
This is corporate.
That's correct. The statute actually currently says that the state has to appear through an attorney, but there are exceptions to that general rule that already reside in other statutes, and so it would not affect those other exceptions.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right.
So basically, if I was a single proprietor LLC, I would not be able to represent myself.
That's correct.
All right. Other questions?
You know, Mr. Chair, I can see corporations. A lot of businesses become LLCs for liability protection, and it's still a single person running a business. So,
well, I think basically what we're hearing is the courts have already determined that this is what has to occur, and basically what we're trying to do is just codify so everyone's on notice before they get into this process. And realizing that they can't actually do what they want to do because the courts aren't going to permit it.
That's absolutely correct, Chair Pozanski. It doesn't change existing. I'm sorry.
No, I understand that, but that's the court's interpretation of existing law, correct? So the difference is I have a grocery store and I'm not organized as anything. I can represent myself, but if I'm organized into a business structure, an LLC, then I can't represent myself. So that's basically the line that's being drawn here. Is that correct?
Chair Pozanski and Senator Cruz, that is correct.
Okay.
And it is also true that already exists within the statute with respect to, for example, a single shareholder corporation. So that already is
right.
True.
Okay. I'm just trying to get the definition.
I appreciate that. Okay. Any other comments or questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And close the public hearings on Senate Bill 2327 as well as 2328. And if we're ready, I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 2327.
Chair, I move House Bill 2327 to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2327 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objections? So ordered. Senator Gelser, will you be the carrier on that one, please?
Yes.
And we'll close the work session on 2327 and open a work session on House Bill 2328.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2328 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2328 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
And just full disclosure, I'm not an LLC. Unfortunately, at the time we incorporated, the only option we had was C. And
you haven't decided to change it since then?
It takes a long period of time, and we have had stockholders aging, and we just aren't quite sure when the appropriate time would be.
Good response. Any other comments? Any objection to the motion? Not seeing any, so ordered. Chair will carry 2328 to the floor. And with that, that concludes our work for today. I believe we're scheduled for tomorrow at 8:30, if I'm not mistaken. So with that, we'll see everyone tomorrow. Thank you.
To convert from a
thank you.
To convert from a
we'll see everyone tomorrow. Thank